I'm Lasaris Perry. You're listening to The Takeaway.
The four LAPD officers in the Rodney King beating case found not guilty on all counts except one.
30 years ago tomorrow, Los Angeles roiled after the acquittal of four LAPD officers who brutally beat Rodney King. The unrest lasted for 5 days. More than 10,000 National Guardsmen and 2,000 federal troops were deployed. More than 50 people lost their lives, and the events caused nearly $1 billion in property damage.
The Rodney King trial brought out the anger and frustration that people were experiencing every day in community with a police department that was engaged in, like, you know, excessive force issues that were harming people, and very, very little was being done. My name is Akilah Shirelles. I am the co-founder of the Community-Based Public Safety Collective and the president and board chair of the Newark Community Street Team.
Shirelles has been organizing for community-based public safety for more than 3 decades.
That day was historic. It also gave birth to what I consider to be one of the most progressive, like, kind of public safety strategies in the history of this country, which was the emergence of the peace treaty, which now, you know, has culminated into a whole movement around community-based public safety.
The peace treaty Shirelles is referring to here was finalized on April 28th, 1 day before the acquittal of the officers. Four Black gangs from public housing communities in Watts worked together to reach a ceasefire. Shirelles, who was a member of the Grape Street Crips, was part of brokering that deal. And he says the ceasefire stayed in effect for roughly a decade. I spoke with Shirelles to mark the 30th anniversary of this truce.
You know, for years, violence was labeled in the community as gang violence. And we know that that label in itself, like, dehumanized the people behind it, and it desensitized the public to the plight of those individuals who are suffering underneath, you know, the trauma. And so when folks utilize language like riot, it puts the onus on the people who are being victimized as if they are responsible, you know, for the trauma and for the harm that they suffered. We like to utilize the word rebellion or unrest because essentially this was a systemic problem that had been happening for decades in LA and across the country in Black and brown communities.
Sticking on that idea, let's go to another word, the word gang. When we say the word gang, I think you're right. It presumes, it reflects all kinds of misunderstandings often. Talk to us about the Bloods and the Crips and what it means to try to use language that fully understands what those organizations mean for the young people involved.
Sure. So gangs are essentially surrogate families because many of those who are participating in these urban gangs lost their nuclear family to the real killer, which is poverty, which is, you know, organized and systemic, right? And so people joined gangs out of a way of protecting themselves. Talking about, like, the history of the Crips and Bloods, right? Before these organizations were, like, kind of formal, these were a loosely set of, like men and women living in neighborhoods who were protecting themselves against groups like the Spook Hunters out of Compton, which was a group of white boys who would come to Watts and just, you know, victimize people just because they were Black, right? You know, this whole idea of gangs, like Black American gangs, you know, Latino gangs are all very different, you know, but when you say gang, it invokes in people's imagination the mafia, that they're organized and centralized, that they have a treasury and an armory. When the reality of gangs, of Black American gangs, is that they're decentralized, they're fractured, and many people, again, join gangs out of a sense of belonging.
I never want to think of good as necessarily springing out of the bad. I think in certain ways that it allows us to say that we don't need to address accountability for the harm that was done. But there is this extraordinary manifestation, this new model of community-based intervention. Talk to me about 1992 and the peace treaty. What is this treaty?
The peace treaty emerged out of the suffering and the conflicts that existed between, you know, warring neighborhoods. In my neighborhood, you know, Watts, largest concentration of public housing west of the Mississippi, your large concentration of poor people and all of the problems, you know, there was a conflict that happened, like, maybe in the early 70s that created a rift Within the community, you know, over that conflict between, you know, a brother from the Nickerson Gardens and the Jordan Downs, hundreds of people lost their lives over a period of about 30 years. And when I was coming up in the 80s, you know, it was the height of the crack cocaine war as well. Crack cocaine blew through our neighborhood like Hurricane Katrina, upturning families. I mean, just decimated the community. Our cry for help was falling on deaf ears. Those who were involved in this interesting, you know, battle that was happening in the neighborhood, we got a level of consciousness because of the music that was coming out of the East Coast, you know, so Public Enemy, X-Clan, you know, KRS-One, this music inspired us, the whole Stop the Killing movement. And we started engaging in different conversations with brothers from all across the city and sisters from all across the city about how can we stop this war that nobody was winning. Every time somebody died, we pour out a little drink for them. We hit their name up on the wall for remembrance, but no one was there to provide direction and guidance for the kids. You said something earlier about, you know, sometimes, you know, the gift is in the wound, right? That's my belief. I believe that it's always darkest before dawn. And so right before, you know, things just kind of turned all the way left, you know, a small group of men and women band together. And we engaged in, you know, years of conversation and dialogue before we actually, my brother Daoud did the research on the Egyptian-Israeli Peace Accord. And so we got this document and we transformed it and changed it. And we utilized it as the basis for this peace agreement that we developed between the four major housing projects. Because Watts was kind of like ground zero for kind of gangsterism on the West Coast and hip hop culture, we utilized that visibility as a way of inviting, you know, other neighborhoods from across the city into this conversation, and it dominoed all across the city. The city adopted our overall strategy, and then brought in the academics to study our work. And organizations grew out of that, like David Kennedy with the National Network of Safe Community, who created this whole targeted deterrence strategy and ceasefire model. But many of the practitioners, you know, our work was absorbed by the city of LA. So they created Bridges One and Bridges Two as the first prevention and intervention programs. And then later on, changed it into GRID, which it is today, the Gang Reduction Youth Development Program. So this work, you know, it's consistently growing and expanding. But yeah, it all started, you know, with a group of men and women in the neighborhood who were just fed up with waiting for elected officials, law enforcement, you know, other folks to come in and solve our problem, you know. And so the whole motto of the peace treaty was that nobody can stop this war but us.
Even as you're talking about this, it resonates so strongly. It sounds so much like so many of the young people that I've been talking with since 2020 who are reimagining, redefining notions of public safety. And that even as defund the police, it was a really powerful and useful sort of tool for describing this reimagining, that it really is this question of, well, what actually makes us safe? What leads us to experience safety in our communities? So kind of reflecting on 2020, were you raising your hand? Were you like, yeah, we actually have done some of this work?
Absolutely. That's right. I mean, community violence intervention, or what we call community-based public safety, because we're defining ourselves today, has been around for 30 years. It's evidence-based. It has anecdotal, you know, support as well as community support. The thing that it didn't have was a strategic investment and political will behind. I mean, the public execution of George Floyd was truly an inflection point in this country, because prior to that, people wouldn't even consider that law enforcement wasn't, you know, this single ubiquitous like kind of place for public safety in our communities. I think that, you know, George Floyd's death created an opening in people's imagination to realize that law enforcement is only one aspect of an ecosystem around public safety, and that public safety is not just the absence of violence and crime. Public safety is also the presence of well-being and the infrastructure to support victims and survivors in their respective healing journey. And that you literally cannot have public safety without the public as a real constituency in the conversation. And so we utilized this framing around reimagining public safety. We were actually talking about it before it became popular, right? Hosted some really powerful town hall conversations in the city of Newark with all of the key stakeholders, brought folks from all across the country. To talk about, like, how you reimagine public safety. It's not reimagining public safety. It's not just about more investment in de-escalation strategies and procedural justice and body cams for cops. It also has to be about investing in community-based and community-led strategies and solutions that have worked in neighborhoods, right? And then also investing in those infrastructure-like kind of systems, you know, that help to make neighborhoods safe. Safety is a kind of is an abstract idea. Public safety is an abstract idea to most people. You know, again, if you say public safety, most people will say police. We don't know how we enter the public safety conversation because for so long it's been a domain that's kind of owned by law enforcement. But I think that with Reimagine, it's given us an opportunity to really expand our perception and conception of what public safety could look like. And so community violence intervention is essentially a complementary strategy to policing. It's about training residents in neighborhoods in conflict resolution, mediation, de-escalation strategies through a trauma-informed lens, right? Through a public health approach, because the public health approach says that those who are closest in proximity to the violence have to be equipped with the skills, the tools, and the resources to actually do the intervention, the prevention, and the treatment.
So I want you to put this down where the goats can get it from me and give me, for my listeners who are like, I just, you know, this just isn't my life. I don't know what we're talking about here. Give me a lived example of this. When is a moment when this version of public safety intervenes and behaves and gives us an outcome that is different than what we might have by calling 911?
So here's an example. In the city of Newark, you know, Newark has been on the, well, in the past, was on the top 10 most violent city list for almost 50 consecutive years. There was a conflict that started at one of the high schools in Newark, at Westside High School, between two rival groups, the Famous Boys and Pilgrim Village. This conflict had brewed out of control for almost 10 years. There was probably a dozen bodies exchanged between these two neighborhoods. And the conflict started over a young woman, on the high school campus 10 years ago, right? But after the bodies start to drop, right, people forget about, you know, what was the initial, you know, infraction that caused the conflict. And so for years, you know, law enforcement was picking off individuals within the conflict. They would have intelligence, but because folks wouldn't come to testify, you know, against each other in court, there was no case. I mean, as I said, there's a pretty high threshold for arrest and prosecution. So these individuals were left, you know, harming each other in the street. In comes, you know, the Newark Community Street Team, the city of Newark's community-based public safety initiative that hires and trains non-traditional leaders, ex-gang members, ex-convicts, ex-drug dealers, trained highly in conflict resolution, mediation, de-escalation strategies. But most importantly, they live in this neighborhood. They are the demographics that they serve. They know Pookie and Raheem and Sabrina now, right? And so essentially over a 2-year period, key partners in the city, you know, from the Newark Community Street Team, from the Newark Anti-Violence Coalition, met with both sides of the conflict. We pulled them to the table. We had significant dialogues and discussions about being able to mediate the conflict. We brought the two key leaders in that conflict to the table, talked with all of the associates. And like I said, over a period of 3 years, we were able to mediate that conflict to a peaceful resolve. Even law enforcement's role in it, because when shootings would happen, because there was a high threshold around arrest and prosecution, it was one-way intelligence giving. They would call us and give us the intelligence that they had because they knew that there was nothing that they can do around the maintenance of those conflicts. So they would give us their intelligence, you know, and share with us so that we could actually step in the gap to prevent some of the retaliatory violence that would happen around this incident. It was unprecedented, you know, being able to mediate that conflict to a peaceful resolve, positioning community-based public safety as a core strategy within the city's coordinated approach to public safety. And this work has been just consistently growing as a result.
Akilah Shirelles, thank you for joining us here on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I appreciate you.
That was Akilah Shirelles, co-founder of the Community-Based Public Safety Collective and president and board chair of the Newark Community Street Team. And stay tuned for more on 30 years since the acquittal of the officers who beat Rodney King, We're going to be back next week with a look at the impact of that week on LA's Korean American community.